When you say the words labor union, some people think of bureaucracy, corruption, and graft, while others think of the continuing fight for fair wages, fair working conditions, and the struggle for social change. With me is one of the most prolific and respected historians on the American labor movement, Philip Foner. He's the author of the 4-volume history of the labor movement in the United States. He's the author of Organized Labor and the Black Worker, and Women and the American Labor Movement, the second volume of which has just been published. Foner is the author of, I think, about 40 books in all, including The Life and Writings of Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois Speaks. He's been a visiting professor in many places. Next September, he's going to Nankai University in the People's Republic of China to be a visiting professor there. Currently, he's a visiting professor at Rutgers University. And I'd just like to mention to you, if you'd like to hear him speak in person, we'll be speaking with him on the show in a minute, but if you'd like to hear him speak in person, he will be appearing at the Northwest Regional Library on Green and Shelton Streets in Germantown to talk on March 15th about the black worker and March 22nd about blacks and the struggle to abolish slavery and March 29th to talk about blacks and the struggle for equality. And if you'd like any information about this series, and it's a whole series of speakers, you can call 735-5574. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Okay.
I had said when I opened this that you say labor union, and some people immediately think of top-heavy labor unions with graft and corruption, while others think of social change. Before we get to some of the aspects of the labor union movement now, in which there's some very interesting struggles happening, I'd like to ask you how you think that some of the unions that are involved with top-heavy bureaucracies got to be that way.
Well, it's a historical process in which the labor movement originally developed with small treasuries, small activities, with great difficulties for trying to achieve what they wanted. And in the process, they developed an ideology called business unionism, which originally meant that the union should be practical, use business-like methods in organizing and carrying on treasuries so that when they went on strike, they would have the means to support their members and welfare and other factors. But as the unions, particularly with the emergence of the American Federation of Labor, whose 100th anniversary we're celebrating this year, became more established and the wealth of the unions grew, they became attractive to people, not in business unionism as a method of being practical, but as becoming sort of a business for individuals who then looked upon unionism as a way of making a good career for themselves and in the process wanted to hold on to that career and thus developed methodologies of maintaining power, bureaucracy, and undemocratic unionism developed. And that, unfortunately, has not been eliminated. In fact, in some ways, it has grown since that time, so that the result is that some unions are dominated by elements who are corrupt and openly so. And frequently, it takes a very long struggle to try to change this. In the case of the mine workers, it took a sudden murder of a man and his Yablonsky and his wife and daughter to bring about some changes. But it's a very tough situation. However, I do want to make one thing clear. That is not true of all unions to start with. And secondly, I think that people should recognize that history proves that workers are better off with unions than without unions. History has shown that the individual worker cannot achieve what workers collectively can achieve. And that's the function of unions, to act collectively in the activity of advancing the interests of the working class.
Sometimes one of the larger unions that you suspect is pretty rife with corruption tries to organize a smaller organization. What do you think are some of the trade-offs for workers in that smaller organization, the trade-offs that they would have in joining a big union?
Well, it would depend on the character of that union. If it was corrupt from top to bottom, I think the trade-off is to stay alone in a small union, because then they would find that in the corrupt union, very often their interests would not be protected. A lot of the corruption that comes in unions comes from employers paying off the union leader for not fighting effectively for the members. Obviously, if an employer can settle with a union leadership for a smaller advance for workers, it pays for him to pay off the leader because he can save a great deal of money. So I would say if the union is corrupt, that it isn't a good idea to be part of it. On the other hand, today, because of the costs involved in administration of unions and inflation and everything else, smaller unions find it difficult to service their members. And that's why there's been a trend towards mergers in the labor movement. That's good, and it could be bad. It depends on the character of the union. A union is as good as its membership, has the opportunity to express their views and bring about progressive changes, democratic changes. If the opportunities don't exist, if they're closed up, if the democratic process really is absent, then it's very difficult for a union to function adequately for the services of its members.
Do you think Americans are disillusioned with the labor union movement in our country?
Well, it depends on what Americans you're talking of. Some Americans are, especially since the media isn't exactly friendly to the labor movement. And in the current situation with the new administration, that is going to increase. For example, some newspapers and the radio and TV commentators would seem to think that if the labor movement doesn't immediately hug Reagan's program to its heart, it is unpatriotic and not servicing properly the interests of the American people, ignoring the fact that the ones who are going to suffer under Reagan's program are the ones whom the labor movement is supposed to protect. Unfortunately, it hasn't too often protected those elements. Now, when they start to do that, I think it's a good thing rather than a bad thing. No, I think that many Americans have been led to feel that unions are corrupt, that they're selfish, that they serve the interests of their own members at the expense of the nation. But I don't think that that's true. I think one of the reasons for that is that our school system, our educational system, does not really tell the truth about history when it comes to the working class. We don't have good courses in our public schools and high schools that tell the story of what labor has contributed to the American nation. And after all, the birth of the American nation, I wrote a book on it called Labor and the American Revolution. It was the labor groups that played the role in the creation of the American nation most actively, and in Philadelphia is one of the big places for it. And the role of labor in the development of public education, in women's suffrage as well as manhood suffrage, in initiative and referendum, in democratic direct primary, in many progressive reforms. That story is not told. Instead, we're told about riots and long strikes. They're part of the story, too. But that's not the whole story. And I think one of the things that has to be done is, it's not a new idea, is to teach the children of the working class the history of their ancestors and what they contributed to our country. Black as well as white. Women as well as men.
Well, you have written a few books on the Black labor union movement and the women's labor union movement.
Yes.
Have both of those groups had a hard time breaking into the labor unions?
That's an understatement. Actually, both of those groups have had a hard time. But of the two, the blacks have had the harder time. Because, to tell you the truth, even when women were permitted to belong to unions, and that was not always the case, and sometimes took a long struggle to achieve that, blacks were not permitted. For example, I was not able to find, in the entire history of the American labor movement, which began in Philadelphia in the 1790s, the first unions were formed in this city, in Philadelphia, and the first city central labor body was established here in 1828, and the first labor party was established here. In fact, Philadelphia is the cradle of the American labor movement. And yet, there isn't a single example of a single trade union that allowed a single black worker to belong before the end of the Civil War. Now, it's true that 4 million of the 4.5 million black workers were slaves. And perhaps we don't expect that the unions would have permitted slaves to become members. But there were 500,000 free black workers in the United States. They were not allowed to belong to unions. They were, in fact, when one organization in Philadelphia proposed that it open its doors to blacks in the 1840s, they were threatened with being excluded from the rest of the labor movement. Racism was unfortunately pretty strongly embedded in the white working class, and that took a long, long time to overcome. It's not yet completely overcome. As late as World War II, many important unions still would not open their ranks to black workers. In this very city, in Philadelphia, in 1944, there was a strike during the war on the rapid transit system, which required President Franklin D. Roosevelt to send 10,000 troops into Philadelphia. What was the strike? It was because the FEPC, the Fair Employment Practice Committee, ordered an upgrading of six black workers who worked in the PRT, the Philadelphia Rapid Transit Line, the streetcars, who were usually porters and sweepers, that's what they were traditionally. Because of a shortage of labor during the war, the FEPC ordered that they be upgraded to conductors and motormen. And the white workers of Philadelphia who belonged to the Transit Workers Union went on strike to protest that. And in order to keep the streetcars going, the troops had to come in. Now, I'm not talking about 1744. I'm talking about 1944 in the city of Philadelphia. But anyway, Philadelphia was long the worst city in the North when it came to black workers, the worst.
What would you say is the amount of progress that blacks have made now in breaking into the union?
A great deal. I would say up to 1935, the dominant experience of the black worker and the labor movement was that of being excluded. The dominant. There were exceptions. The United Mine Workers, unions here and there, left unions particularly. But the main experience was that of not being allowed to belong. Some unions even had clauses in their constitutions belonging to the AFL and all the railroad brotherhoods saying that only white workers could belong to the unions. So they were kept out altogether. Others did it by other methods. With the formation of the CIO in 1935, this gradually began to change because the CIO, industrial unionism, opening the doors to all workers, regardless of race, creed, color, sex, if they're going to organize the mass production industries as they planned, they had to do that. And I know because I taught for them at that time. You began to see the change take place. So that over the years, exclusion began to disappear. Today, there are two main problems that face blacks with the labor movement. No longer is it what it used to be, exclusion. That isn't the issue any longer, to a great extent. It is first that they're in some unions, they are still second-class members, not first-class. They do not have the influence in terms of their role that they should play in leadership positions that they should play in a democratic union. That's one of their complaints, and there is even an organization, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, that was organized in 1968 to try to deal with this question. The second thing is the old problem, which is very difficult to solve, namely the what is called the last to be hired and first to be fired. The vast unemployment among black workers, which comes from a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons is that they lack seniority. And when it's what I call the revolving door experience. Blacks tend to come into industry during periods of expansion, especially war periods. World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War. That's when they move in a big numbers. Then in the post-war period or the recession period, since they have come in last, they are often the first to be fired because they have the least seniority. Now, of course, over the years, black workers build up seniority, except in some unions where no matter how long they were, they had two separate seniority lines in steel, for example, for black and white. That problem is still a serious one of how to solve the job problem. Of course, in some industries like automobile and steel, it's a serious problem for both white and black workers as industries shut down. But of the two, the black workers have been the toughest to feel that experience, and especially black youth. Now, black youth, the problem is enormous in our country. Enormous. In fact, just 2 days ago, the New York Times ran an editorial questioning one's authority in the academic world, who, from Johns Hopkins, who said, well, he said, this problem of black unemployment among youth, black youth, is not too serious because we're not taking into consideration the increase in the number of blacks who go to college, and who, therefore, the percentage would not be as great as we think it is. But as the Times pointed out, that's a very spurious argument, because there is an enormous black unemployment among youth. And the tragedy of it is that even the big authorities, like those who at UFP, University of Pennsylvania, who have been studying this question for 10 to 20 years, have thrown up their hands. They have said there is no solution.
Well, did you agree with that there's no solution?
Well, I don't agree that there is no solution, but I want to say that I don't think there is an easy solution to it. Actually, I think that's one of the toughest problems in the country today. I don't think the Reagan administration is going to touch that in any real way.
Well, you know,
because they're going to depend upon private industry doing it. Well, private industry has failed to do it up to now.
There's been one proposal that's been made by a few people, one of whom lives in our area, who said, well, you know, one incentive of giving businesses to hire teenagers would be to abandon the minimum wage for teenagers.
I know. That, incidentally, is a very common theme among some black scholars like Solow over in the California, University of California. The idea is, yes, the reason why blacks are unemployed is because as they do such unproductive work that as the minimum wage is raised, it doesn't pay to hire them. And therefore, the way to solve the problem is to bring down the minimum wage. But that's not going to solve the problem for the simple reason that the kind of work that blacks used to do, black youth, doesn't exist anymore. In what sense? Traditionally, blacks were workers who did unskilled, menial work in industry and outside of industry. At one time, they did a lot of skilled work, and in the South for a long time, but they were pushed out of the skilled occupations. Philadelphia is a good example. At one time in Philadelphia, if you were in the 1810, 1820, for example, if you walked along Chestnut Street or Walnut Street or any other street at the time and you saw shops, you'd find a lot of black carpenters and bricklayers and skilled workers. There was a scarcity of labor, and the blacks who were slaves in Philadelphia, slavery was abolished gradually after 1780, were skilled workers. After all, there was no big plantations in Pennsylvania or Philadelphia. But gradually, they were pushed out by immigrants and into the unskilled ranks, so that by the 1850s, there were hardly any skilled workers anymore who were blacks. Or if they were, they couldn't work any longer. By 1900, when W.E.B. Du Bois made his classic study, The Philadelphia Negro, which U of P published, he found that the blacks simply were not employed as skilled workers any longer in Philadelphia. The tragedy was that they weren't even employed in the factories. By 1913, for example, when Philadelphia was a major industrial city, there were hardly any blacks working in America in Philadelphia factories. And sometimes it was the black woman who was a laundress or a washerwoman who kept the black family alive. Well, they did menial work. And during World War I, this situation changed because the usual supply of workers who did the work in the factories, the unskilled and semi-skilled work, were the immigrants from Europe, the Poles, the Hungarians, the Bohemians, the Italians, and others. Well, World War I stopped that. And as a result, the industrialists went down south and brought up large numbers of blacks to Chicago and Detroit and Philadelphia, too. In fact, the big growth in Philadelphia's black population began in earnest during World War I in what is called the Great Migration. So they came into industry, and they continued after the war because immigration never reached the pre-war heights. One of the reasons was that we had quotas, you know, the labor movement and other groups kept immigration restricted. So opportunities for blacks in industry did exist. But what sort of work did they do? They did the unskilled work in major industries. And black youth did the major unskilled work. Well, in the last 15 years, mechanization and more development of specialization has eliminated a lot of unskilled work. So you can pick up the New York Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer on Sunday and find a lot of advertisements for what? For computer engineers, for technicians. But I don't have to tell you that our education system is so terrible in our cities for black youth that they don't qualify for these positions. Some of them have difficulty filling out even employment forms. Functionally, they're called functionally illiterate. So how are they going to do skilled work? So the unskilled work has been eliminated to a large extent. So what do you solve by reducing the minimum wage? You don't solve that problem. You've got to come to grips with the educational system, with new opportunities to prepare black youth for the kind of jobs that they can do without reducing the minimum wage. This is an illusion that you can solve the problem by simply reducing the minimum wage. You know what will happen? You'll then find that they'll use this as a means of saying to the adult worker, well, if you want to do this work, you've got to come down to that minimum because we can get your youth to do the work very cheaply. And history has proved that that's a gimmick that's been used again and again. We don't have to go through that anymore.
As you say, the nature of work has changed, and a lot of the plants have closed up and left. A lot of them.
That's another thing.
A lot of them
that's
have
a separate
moved.
Thing. That is, a lot of plants have closed up because the industry is incapable of functioning in the face of competition from abroad, and that's not the fault of the black worker or the white worker. It's the fault of our brilliant-minded industrialists, who are to be reshaping the new America and have proved to be so great and genius in their thinking that they have ruined an automobile industry and even a steel industry, while the Germans and the Japanese seem to be able to function effectively. You can't blame that on the black worker, and certainly can't blame that on the white worker either.
How effective do you think labor unions have been in trying to prevent plants from moving from one city and into another? Because that's something that we're experiencing a lot now in the Delaware
yes.
Valley.
Well, I wouldn't say they've been very effective. One of the reasons why they move, especially to the Sun Belt, is because these areas have what is called right-to-work laws, which makes it difficult for unions to organize there. And that has been an inducement for industries to get out of the Northeast, where blue-collar workers belong in larger numbers to trade unions. Now, the unions have not been able to stop that, but it's not a new phenomenon. For example, the textile industry moved into the South right after World War I in large numbers. J.P. Stevens, for example, this famous J.P. Stevens, was originally a New England company. And they moved to North Carolina partly to be closer to the raw materials, but mainly to get rid of unions, which they succeeded in doing, by the way, until the first union contract was signed in October 1980 by J.P. Stevens. And rather interesting, in the very plant where the film Norma Rae is centered, you see, because Norma Rae is an event that really took place in the plant in Raleigh at J.P. Stevens in North Carolina.
Well, that's an example, I think, of one of the places where you see a lot of activity, interesting activity happening in the labor union movement, and that's in labor unions that have a lot of women and in women's trades.
Well, it's not new, but there is something new there, and that is that this isn't a significant breakthrough. The fact that an actual union contract was signed by J.P. Stevens, because in a certain sense, J.P. Stevens occupies in the South a position vis-a-vis trade unions that GM used to occupy in vis-a-vis the United Automobile Workers. When the UAW broke through in General Motors in the sit-down strike of 1937 in Flint, that opened the door for a lot of union organizing. And the possibility exists that the agreement in J.P. Stevens could open the door for organizing in the South, but it won't come by praying for it. It's going to require very hard, steady work. There are certain developments that have taken place in the South that are promising in this connection. One, as you said, women. But women have been, this is not a new thing. Women have been very active in the labor movement for over 150 years, practically. And in the South, too, you know, for example, in the 1929 to 30 struggles in Gastonia, Marion, and many other textile strikes of that period, women were very active and very important. But there is one new development that is very, I think, very significant, and I think was a very important factor in the victory here. And that's brought out, by the way, in the film, Norma Rae. And that is the presence of black workers in textile. Traditionally, black workers never worked in textile in the South except as sweepers and porters. Most of the workers were hill country people, brought down from the hill country, mountain people into North Carolina, West Virginia, South Carolina, to work in the textile mills. And the blacks were kept out. But in the last 15 or 20 years, as other industries have moved into the South, military bases, electronics, computers, and other things, the Sun Belt growth, white workers have moved out of the textile industry in larger numbers, and the textile industry, in order to get labor, has had to bring in black workers to do work at the machine. You remember in Norma Rae, if you saw it, that you saw black workers working at the machines. Well, you wouldn't have seen that 25 years ago in the South at all. Now, that has brought into the industry an element that the industry felt they could use to keep out the union by playing white against black. You know, even in fact in the film, you remember there's one scene where the black worker is beaten up by white workers in the union because the company has spread the rumor that the blacks are going to take over the union, you see, if they actually get a union. But it didn't work. The blacks were militant and active, and the whites learned that if they're going to fall for this thing, they'll end up by injuring themselves. So it didn't really succeed, and I think that, and the blacks turned out to be among the most active in the union fight. So I think that's an important sign that holds out promise in the South.
So many.
That, by the way, is one of the reasons why the Ku Klux Klan has been revived in the South.
You think so, really?
Oh, yes, definitely.
That's a really interesting
North Carolina. Because of this growing unity of black and white in the textile industry, which is a new phenomenon. The use of the Klan is to be expected. It's a weapon, just like the Black Legion did that job in Michigan back in the 1930s. You may not remember it, but to break up the unity of black and white during World War II. And so it's not to be surprised that this would develop.
Are you saying that at all that they're acting on behalf of the employers?
Well, they have had a history of doing that in the South.
That's really interesting.
Yes. They started in that way. They acted in behalf of the landlords against the sharecroppers and tenants. That was one of their main purposes of the Klan originally, to keep the blacks as sharecroppers and tenants from protesting the conditions under which they worked back in 1866, 67, 68, 69. So it's a history of this that goes all the way back.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners who are just tuning in. My guest is Dr. Philip Foner, who's a historian, and we're talking about some of his findings in labor history, and he's written numerous books. A new volume that is the companion to his first volume on women in the American labor union movement has just been published. As you point out in that book, the number of women who are entering the workforce and who have entered the workforce during the past 10 or 15 years has has added a lot to the labor union movement.
I wouldn't say that.
Changed the nature of it?
It's added a lot to the workforce.
To the workforce.
It has the potential of adding a lot to the labor union movement. Actually, that is one of the problems. It's a contradiction in a sense. The number of women who have increasingly gone into the workforce, for example, today, as the figures of 1978, 52% of women work in the workforce, as opposed to women who are at home. Now, that's the first time in the entire history of the United States that more women are actually working outside the home than work in the home. I'm not saying work in the home is not work. It is. I even believe it should be paid, and maybe the time will come when there will be an understanding of that this is work that should be properly rewarded. But at present is not, and 52% now work outside the home. Well, that's a new phenomenon. I'm not saying new in the sense that it being more, but the number of women who are in the labor movement, the unions, has not been growing to the same extent. In fact, it's been declining. That is, the ratio of women who work to the number of women in the union movement to those who work has been declining. During World War II, for example, at one point you had over 3 million women in the trade union movement. Of course, Rosie the Riveters were more numerous at that time, and they were doing the kind of work which women traditionally don't usually do, because after the war they were pushed back into what is called the traditional work. But one of the major problems that the labor movement faces today is to organize women who are in the workforce into the trade unions, because if the number of women increase and the number of women in the unions decline, the percentage of workers in the unions are going to grow less and less. The trend has been anyway to grow less and less, so this is a big problem. Now, there is some recognition of this. One of the signs of that recognition is that the AFL-CIO, at long last, in a sense it's almost humorous, but at long last, appointed a woman to the executive council of the AFL-CIO. For the first time in the history of the AFL-CIO, a woman was selected for the executive council. I would go further. For the first time in the history of the American Federation of Labor, and that runs 100 years, the CIO did have one before they joined, but the AFL didn't. That's Joyce Miller of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. What was unique about it is that this is the first time that they appointed or elected a person to the executive council who is not the leader or president of an international union. Because if they had to wait for that, they never would have had a woman. So they decided to dispense with the rules. The reason for that is that these men are waking up to the fact that unless they organize the women workers, the union movement is going to be very weak. This is the new element that has to be organized. It's not easy. And one of the first things they have to do is to convince women that the men are sincere when they talk about fighting for the interests of the working women. The history hasn't been very helpful in that respect.
Well, as you've pointed out, there's a lot of women working in fields where there aren't any men to organize them, and fields that have traditionally been unorganized, like clerical workers.
Yeah, well, incidentally, it doesn't necessarily mean that men are the only people to organize women.
Which isn't what I meant either. No, but
on the contrary, one of the mistakes that the labor movement often made was that they only appointed men to organize women, and this wasn't a very smart thing to do. Because especially if they appointed men who didn't have much sympathy for working women. No, you are raising another question, and that is a big question today, and it's one of the questions which the labor movement has not yet come to grips with, and it is one of the issues they'll have to come to grips with. And that is the fact that the women are locked into what is called the traditional woman's job. I don't like the term traditional, so let's say in what's called women's work. Clerical work, service work, the work that is... And since they're locked in to these jobs and can't easily move into the better paying, the more skilled, the more advantageous jobs, they compete with each other, bring down the wages, and make it very difficult to lift them in terms of their conditions. The film 9 to 5 is an example. Most women are office workers. And office workers are difficult to organize. They are among themselves, individual, but it can be done. There are groups that are doing it. But the bigger problem is, how do you open up the door for women to move into other fields? That has to be tackled. During World War II, they did. The nation needed them. So you had molders, and you had airplane riveters, and you had machinists, and all kinds of work that women did. The view that women could do this work disappeared. Rosie the Riveter proved that women were as good workers on skilled work as the men. They had proved it in World War I. They always have to prove it again and again. But when the war comes to an end, what happens? Well, the boys come back, they have the seniority, and at the same time, a whole ideology begins to develop in the media, saying Rosie should go back home and do the work that women have traditionally done, namely raise a good family, cook the supper, and have the cocktail ready when the husband comes home after the hard work in the office. And that's the traditional role of women. And they were pushed out in most cases.
It's the same thing you said about black workers who are pushed out in times of recession.
Yeah, well, except that there's one difference. Whereas white women could move into a certain type of skilled work during the war, it wasn't so easy for the blacks, especially black women. There is a certain common experience that white women and blacks, men and women, have. They are always the ones who are discriminated against when it comes to the better jobs. There is also unions which tend to discriminate against blacks, discriminate against women. Unions which open their doors to blacks have traditionally been more inclined to open their doors to women. But there are differences too. Unions which open their doors to white women will not necessarily open their doors to black women or black men. We put it this way historically. Workers have different types of burdens to bear. A worker starts out with a certain thing. He is a worker, he has certain problems. A woman has two problems as a worker. She's a worker and she has a sexist problem. Sexual harassment, the traditional job, the exclusion from unions, etc. The black has three problems. He has what we call, he's a worker, or she. There is the problem of, if it's a black woman, being a woman. But there's also the problem of race. So you have three burdens. And that's difficult, very, very difficult in America to overcome. So you have to keep in mind that these experiences are different, although in some ways they're similar.
When we're talking about women entering the workforce and women starting to enter unions and to form unions in what have traditionally been women's fields, are we talking about white women or are we talking about a multiracial group of women?
Well, it varies. I mean, in some areas, we're talking only about white women because in office work for a long time, they didn't hire blacks at all, black women. That has broken down. But if you were to make a study in 1935, or 1940, of women in offices, the percentage of black women who worked in offices would be minuscule, would be practically non-existent. So you'd have to say, if you're talking about women in office work, you're talking only about white women. That has changed. But still, the vast majority are still white. Today, you'd have to say there are more blacks, multinational, Chicano, etc. But now, in some areas, there you're talking of a multiracial group. For example, needle trades today, many of the workers are of different nationality groups: Puerto Ricans, blacks, Chicanos. Chinese, Japanese, these very multi. Of course, unfortunately, some of the old problems are reappearing. Taking advantage of this situation of special exploitation of these minority group of workers, especially the so-called illegal aliens, the old sweatshops and the terrible exploitation in the needle trades is reappearing. And the old struggles that used to people thought were over, like the great struggles of the needle trades of the 1909 to 1913, the 1920s, are having to start again.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people feel that that they're losing ground, and whatever struggles they thought were won are suddenly being lost again. Do you think, looking back at history, that struggles are really never won for good, that no gains can ever be taken for granted?
Well, one, I wouldn't say the two are compatible. First of all, I would say, I would tend to agree. Struggles are never won for good if you relax. You see, first of all, I happen to believe, not all labor historians believe this, that there is a struggle between labor and capital. I'm a believer in what is called, slightly un-American perhaps, but unfortunately American history is full of it, of the class struggle between labor and capital. Now, that is an unending struggle. And if you don't believe it, go into an industry town and look at the situation. Of course, there are some professors and historians who will shrink at the thought. But let's say it exists. Now, any victory that's won by a trade union, if they're not alert and if they're not constantly watching, they will be taken away, because the employer will seek to take away as much as he can. And we have histories of this. So just winning is not enough. You have to have a strong organization and an honest one to make sure that what you won is enforced. I tell you, if you were to write the history of the American labor movement in terms of victories alone, of contracts, the workers might be in the Elysian Fields today. Unfortunately, not all contracts are always lived up to by the employer, and the union didn't always make sure that it was lived up to. But, so I would say that it's a constant struggle to make sure that your victories are retained. Secondly, there is no other way. Of course, there are setbacks. You go ahead for a certain time, and then suddenly a new administration comes in, and I think we're in that situation today, which is going to try to wipe out many of the gains that were won over the past. But that's not the first time it's been done. During World War I, the labor movement made many advances. When the war was over, we were faced with the open shop drive, the American plan, the Red Scare, to try to take away everything that was gained and prevent future advances. How do you stop this? Well, there's no guarantee that you can, but if you don't fight it, you'll never stop it. That's what history shows. And I think the labor movement had better begin. And they're beginning a little. I mean, there's action on a coalition with certain groups on the question of the food stamps and other things. And this is important. We certainly don't want to see things which were fought for just taken away like this. OSHA, I think that's an area, by the way, where workers are very conscious and sensitive. This whole question of environmental protection, what happens in a plant for an accident. Workers are growing very, very conscious of this. And if they try to take that away, there's going to be a lot of fighting in this country.
Well, you know, the argument that's always used, like here in Philadelphia when the Right to Know bill was before city council, the argument that was being used against the bill was, well, you know, if you force companies working with possibly toxic chemicals to reveal what those chemicals are, they might leave and we can't afford to lose them. Then where will the workers be if they go move somewhere else where there isn't a right to know bill?
Are they going to leave because they are revealing secrets, or is because they have to do something which they should do in the first place? I mean, nothing that, in, as I understand it, in the bill or the law threatens their profits other than the fact that they have to be careful not to injure their workers. Who gave them the right to say that because their profits might be interfered with, they can do what they want? After all, the experience in over in near Buffalo ought to teach some lessons. Do we have to go through that again? No, I think that's a rather weak argument.
I'd love to hear your critique of supply-side economics.
Well, there's nothing to critique. It hasn't proved itself. Let's see. I think it's all based on a hypothesis. Of course, now it's rather interesting. Tonight, Prime Minister Thatcher is coming here. Now, she was supposed to be the leading exponent in Europe of supply-side economic. But evidently, it didn't do so well for British industry and for the British people and for the British working class. Inflation is higher. Unemployment is monstrous. So now they're saying, well, she really didn't apply supply-side economics fully. She was forced to retreat. Well, she really didn't retreat very much. And the only ones who forced her to retreat were the miners. But actually, my own feeling is that supply-side economics will prove very useful for those who are looking for more profits and more wealth without being taxed. Let's put it this way. We have, as a driver of an automobile, I've seen a little supply-side economics in the last month. When the administration removed the controls on oil ahead of time, we were told that the most there might be a 5 cents a gallon increase. Supply-side economics would make sure that it would stay at that point. Well, we're way out of that already. And my guess is that we'll find ourselves more and more having to pay a great deal. And the oil companies will not suffer from supply-side economics, although workers, I think, will. You see, I was in Europe teaching for the last 6 months, and one big difference between... In Europe, it is true, they pay a high price for gasoline. It's not new. But you have to remember that you can't compare the European situation with our country. First of all, the transportation system there is so remarkable that you can get anywhere. You don't have to have a car. And in fact, many people do not have cars. Workers can get to work and find ways of moving around the country adequately with fine railroad transportation, bus transportation, that makes our country look like the 17th century. I think that the American people ought to wake up to the fact that we don't rate when it comes to certain services in terms of we have become an automobile-controlled country. Now, so why can you compare a worker who has to drive to work, a drive to shop, cutting into his income all the time that he uses his car, with a worker in Europe who can use a bicycle easily or use a train or a bus where the absolute adequate transportation exists? There are areas 20 to 30 miles from Philadelphia where if you don't have a car, you might as well live in the 16th century. I know, I lived in such areas. You couldn't go 10 miles, 5 miles, 3 miles to shop or anything else without a car. And so you have a burden to bear that just isn't fair, especially since the profits aren't growing all the time.
I think part of the premise of Reagan's new plan is that new profits that are made by business will be reinvested back into the community through more jobs and through, I think the understanding is that the business will take up some of the slack in community programs and community welfare where the government is dropping off. Do you think that would prove to be the case?
First of all, I don't think that they even dream of that. I don't know where you got that idea. And secondly, if they do, it'll be the most utopian dream that I've heard in recent years. Business has not been willing to take up anything in the past in that sense. So what gives you the idea that they're willing to do it now? I don't see that at all. I would say this. The supply-side economics and the administration believes that if you give industry the incentive in oil, we won't be so dependent upon foreign oil. They'll drill. Well, I myself feel that they're not going to drill any new oil. Actually, we know that they've gone into chemicals, into coal and other things. And who's going to control it? We don't say to them, look, we'll give you this profit incentive provided that you guarantee to do it. It's up to them to decide what to do. After all, if we were to say that you have to do it, we would be violating the Reagan theory that we have no right to tell business what to do. So they can have it both ways. They can have all the profit they want with the understanding they're supposed to do something for the benefit of the community, but the government has no right to tell them that they should do something for the benefit of the community. So what if they don't? And what are you going to do to them? Well, you'll appoint them to higher positions.
I think in this country it's fair to say that labor has traditionally been suspicious of industry, of employers, you know, of
management.
I
don't think that's true.
You don't think that's true?
No. I think, unfortunately, many unions have not been sufficiently suspicious of employers at times. Well, there's been too cozy a relationship in our history between certain labor leaders and industry. Well, I know this won't sit well with some, but it's true. Listen, after all, it started with the National Civic Federation around 1900, 1901, when Gompers and Mitchell and all the big labor leaders sat down with three, four times a year, marvelous dinners at the sumptuous hotels and banquets with the Morgan representatives, the Rockefellers, the Guggenheims, and the others, Belmonts, while these people were refusing to recognize unions in their particular place and working out deals which benefited a small section of the working class, the skilled workers, at the expense of the unskilled, the women, the blacks, etc. That cozy relationship hurt the working class. It didn't help it.
Well, that kind of answers the question in a way that I was going to ask you, which is why do you think that so many working people in this country are rallying behind this new economic plan?
Well, I think the reason is that they have no alternative. What did the previous administration do for them? So their feeling must be, this can't do any worse, at least see what we're giving. After all, I think we should remember one thing. Look how many people didn't rally behind either candidate. The highest number of non-voters in the history of the United States. That tells us something. If you add the number of non-voters to the voters who didn't vote for Reagan, I don't think that he had a great mandate from the American people. He had a minority mandate. It's true he was elected, but I wouldn't say that he was overwhelmingly elected in terms of all the people who had the right to vote and could have voted. That's they have to keep that in mind. And I think that you remember the famous story that appeared in the New York Times during the election, which everybody in Europe was very amused by, which said about someone coming over to a potential voter and saying, quick, putting a gun to the potential voter's head and saying, quick, Carter or Reagan, or I'll shoot. And he says, shoot. Well, I mean, the idea is, what choice have you offered us? Really, I would say historically, the choice was so limited that most people felt, how could we do worse?
We only have about a minute left. Where are you looking now for the most exciting movement within labor?
Well, I think there are movements. For example, there's a group of auto workers who are organizing because their industries have been shut down to try to do something about reopening the industries that have been closed down. That the machinist union, Wimpersinger, has some very interesting ideas. Even the traditional conservative leaders this last this last meeting of the AFL-CIO Executive Council did talk in terms of beginning to make an alliance with other groups to make sure that the burden does not fall on the backs of the ordinary and poor people. But I think the most interesting development is the outspoken and very advanced thinking of the Black Caucus in Congress. They have minced no words and have said clearly that what this program is, and I think it's time that the labor movement got behind them and really stood up and in support of that idea. I don't agree that the American people are going to accept this so readily. I think when they see the reality, they're going to realize that the burden is going to fall upon them.
Dr. Philip Foner, it's been extremely interesting to have you here, and I really hope you could come back and talk with us again soon on Fresh Air. I've so much enjoyed hearing
you. I just want to make one correction. My History of the Labor Movement is 5 volumes, not 4.
Okay. Okay. There's more to read. Okay.
There'll be a 6th and 7th soon.
And if you're interested in women in the American labor movement, the second volume of his 2-volume book, Women in the American Labor Movement, has just been published, and this is from World War I to the present, and that's published on the Free Press. If you'd like to hear Philip Foner speak in person or meet him, he'll be speaking on 3 consecutive Sundays at the library in Germantown on Green and Shelton Avenues, and this is a program being sponsored by the Philadelphia Area Cultural Consortium. The dates are March 15th, March 22nd, and March 29th from 2 to 3:30. For any more information, you can call 735-5574. That's 735-5574. Philip Foner is currently a visiting professor at Rutgers University, and in September he leaves for China. Will he will be a visiting professor at the Nankai University.